I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and this is Radio versus the Martians. I love that Reddit itself is as diverse a spectrum as the entire internet is, and one of them being the niche subreddits that exist are just bonkers,
and not like just the racist ones.
Not like the ones that are, you know, with really just grotesque content, be it sexual or violent or whatever. But like, I don't even know why I ended up. I think it was just accidentally clicked on this. There is a
accidentally clicked on this.
This is oops, didn't mean to. This is a sub about people doing stuff intentionally then pretending it was not on purpose. In general, severe backpedaling.
So it's like the beginning of any Coen Brothers movie.
Yes.
Where it's, oh my God, oh my God. And then everything just hijinks ensue.
Well, no, and it's about that awkward face that people make when they go, oh, oh, no, and they try to, you know, they're trying to desperately dig themselves out.
Try to catch that vase that you just, it's wobbling on top of a stool. It's, no! Yeah, I can imagine something like that would, I guess you could build an internet thing. There's some weird shit on the internet, like.
No.
No. Yeah, I think the weirdest thing I'd heard of, and I actually had to Google it to make sure that it was real, was it was mentioned in another podcast. Somebody was talking about this. I'm like, there's no way. There's no way that this is real. There's no way that this is a thing that somebody is doing. But apparently, and I think this may be a oops, I didn't mean to sort of thing. I think it may have started out ironically, but became sincere or attracted sincere, or people found out they were into it, trying to play it off as, you know, I'm just messing around, which is people creating art based around the idea of dragons having sex with cars.
No, anything involved with Rule 34, I just describe total sincerity. Because consider how long it, even if you are skilled, on a like a little tablet thing on in Illustrator or whatever, it still will take you, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes, half an hour to just sort of pen out, you know, like Mario having sex with Samus Aran from Metroid. You know, it still takes them a long time. So there's enough time in the middle of that process for someone to basically stop and think, what am I doing?
Yeah.
What am I doing with my life?
Yeah, but some of these people...
Yes, it has to be sincere, is what I'm saying.
It has to be to some extent. I mean, maybe it started out as I think this is funny, but then somebody had a moment of clarity at some point and goes, holy shit, I think I'm really into this.
Yes.
But yeah.
I think I'm sick. I just think of that that scene from Happiness. Did you ever see Todd Solondz's Happiness?
I haven't.
Okay. All right. Well...
If spoil
it's just, I mean, so Dylan Baker, I'm sure you're aware of this guy. He's definitely a character actor, and he's this sort of thin white guy who is usually pretty nevish.
He plays Kirk Connors in the Spider-Man movies,
yes,
doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah.
So Dylan Baker in this sort of vignette, it's like a series of vignettes that are connected. He plays a child molester, a man who's a child molester, who during the course of the movie... He drugs and rapes his neighbor's kid, his kids, like the neighbor kids, at a sleepover party. And in the middle of the night, he's like worried. This is after, and he's feeling guilt, and he's laying in bed with his wife, and his wife's already asleep, and he tries to wake her up, and he says, "I'm really sick," you know, like he's really tortured. But then it's the comedy of this scene. Is that his wife thinks that he's just like, oh, I have a headache or something. And she's like, take an aspirin, and rolls over and goes back to sleep. That's kind of what I'm thinking, is that maybe if you're that kind of person on the internet, you're like that. And you're just like, oh, I'm really sick. But no,
I have a
no
problem,
one,
but I'm just playing it off as a joke.
Oh, no. Yeah, just that, or no one listens to you because it's the kind of problem that people are like, ha, 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 ha. Oh, I don't want to talk about this.
Yeah, it's weird because I'm like, the amount of work that goes into some of these where it is really like, this is... I'm not going to say Pixar quality animations, but certainly as good as most things on television. And
yeah.
I mean, why?
Certainly as good as your average Korean animation studio can do, right?
I mean, definitely better than anything that I would play off as I'm just doing this as a joke to see if I can get a rise out of somebody on the internet. This is like painstaking work. And I remember, I don't know how, I was on a date and we were going through these trying to figure out which ones were sincere and which ones were people doing it as a joke.
I don't know by what rubric can you use to figure out whether the intention of the artist?
I think with the face expression of the dragon.
Some
of them are looking kind of coy. And I think it was the weirdest thing in the world. But yeah, so it's a mixture of these things. And I think at some point somebody doesn't intend it to be serious, but somewhere along the way it becomes serious. And the internet is a remarkable ability to help people find people like them. Sometimes that's not always the best thing in the world. Sometimes it's like conspiracy people. Sometimes it's like racists. Sometimes it's like kind of a weird fetish. I mean, if you're not hurting anyone, I really don't give a shit. But, you know, if somebody's into watching dragons fuck cars, you know, then, you know, more power to you. Just don't try to fuck my car.
Did you ever find someone who did a picture of a dragon fucking a transformer?
Oh, God, that's the next stage, isn't it?
I mean, the iterations are infinite, right? I mean, you could just go as far as you wanted to. But I could imagine you can. It's like a top, then bottom sort of thing. The dragon could be fucking a transformer in car form, and then it could transform into the robot and then fuck the dragon. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It could be two panels.
It's yin and yang.
Yeah.
So I've been kind of struggling with something a little bit lately, and it's that... you ever watch a TV show that you don't really enjoy, but you're kind of watching it habitually? And I wanted to believe I was sort of over this behavior, but I don't know if I really am.
This was the stop hitting yourself for comic books, right?
Yeah, I got better at that. I am a lot better at this than I used to be. There's little pieces that I like, but... Okay, let's just throw it out there.
Yeah,
it's a TV show, Fear the Walking Dead, which is a spinoff to, of course, The Walking Dead.
Right, right.
And this is the most frustrating show I've seen in years.
Which you would have expected. This was the idea of being a spinoff was almost inevitable, considering how much of a popularity powerhouse Walking Dead is, not only for sort of comic book crossovers, but for AMC, who, you know, they've sort of lost their flagship show with Breaking Bad and Mad Men. And Walking Dead, I think, is probably their biggest TV show. So, of course, they're going to cash in.
Yeah,
on
they
it.
Got Walking Dead. You've Better Call Saul. They still have a spinoff of that,
right,
which is an example of a great spinoff.
Right. It's funny that they both exist side by side on the same network, those two.
So Fear the Walking Dead, I think we've had this conversation before, both on the show and in private as well, the idea of what necessitates creating a spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's kind of two things. One is this thing is super popular. People really love it. They want to give us money and ratings for it. So let's give them more of the thing that they want.
Of course.
That there's a demand, and the demand fuels creating this thing. Then I think there's the other one, which is there's a story that I'm dying to tell, and it doesn't really fit in the thing that we already have. So I have to tell this story, but it doesn't really work. It's like if there's stories on Deep Space Nine that you can't tell on Star Trek The Next Generation, you need a separate show in a different setting and different characters.
Because
I think a lot of Deep Space Nine stories would threaten to break Star Trek The Next Generation.
Of course.
I mean, and I think that this is a second model, which is that this is a different kind of show. I have an idea, I have a vision, and I have a story that I have to tell. I don't think that's the case with Fear the Walking Dead. The Walking Dead, of course, is based on an idea that Robert Kirkman have of what about the zombie story that never ends, that at the end of like Dawn of the Dead, they're flying off in the helicopter, they don't have a lot of fuel, you don't know what's going to happen next. And he was always fascinated, he says in interviews, with the idea of what now? What do you do after everything falls apart and have to start from scratch again? What happens after that dark ending where people barely survive? And a lot of The Walking Dead is based on that. It just kind of keeps going. That characters cycle in and out. People die. But, you know, life goes on. And this, you know, the zombie apocalypse doesn't just stop one day. So I think with Fear the Walking Dead, it doesn't have that drive. It doesn't have that thing at its core that makes it different. But I think, I mean, it's good in the sense that it isn't just saying, hey, we're going to give Daryl his own show and we're going to spin him off there and this is about him as a different group of survivors in the same part of the country doing something slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't like Laverne and Shirley coming from Happy Days, sort of things, right?
It's just or Joey or any of these other
Frasier
shows.
Coming from Cheers or something, right?
Yeah, yeah, the idea of let's take a character and that's really popular and then build an entire show around them.
Right.
It's the same setting. It's the same, you know, background. The zombie apocalypse is happening to everybody in the world at once, so you could do basically anything with it. That was always one of the bonuses of the book World War Z, is not making it really provincial, branching out and saying, let's look at this from the 10,000-foot level.
Sure.
And I think with this one, it's still the, you know, a small family of people surviving. And at first, I think the setting idea for Fear of the Walking Dead was, what about what happens at the beginning of a zombie apocalypse when society hasn't quite fallen, but it's starting to fray? Which I think is pretty fascinating, but there's only so long before you could have to get to the zombie apocalypse part. And that's really just the first half of the first season. And what I think the problem with this show is that it never gives any idea time to breathe. That it's just throwing shit against the wall. It never has a core concept. That in the original Walking Dead, the first season has a bunch of the survivors on the outskirts of Atlanta. Second season, they're at a farm. The third season and like fourth and stuff, they're like at the prison. And then the most recent season,
following pretty closely the arc, the same arc in the comic book, the ongoing comic book series.
Exactly. Yeah. That there's different settings, and it's always about survival and trying to hold on to stuff. But you looked at that they would stay in a setting for a time that they can pull stories out of it. What is the thing of staying at the farm? Well, somebody owns that place, and they might not have infinite resources to be able to support all these extra mouths. And also, what about, you know, philosophical differences between, you know, Herschel the farmer and Rick the survivor?
Sure.
What if you're like, what if they don't want you to kill zombies? These are their neighbors. Suddenly, it's not a bunch of random people. Every zombie that comes staggering down the street is a neighbor, somebody they knew. So it makes it a lot more personal. So you can pull a lot of stories out of the pressure of these two groups of people trying to coexist and it getting more and more tense. The same thing with, you know, the third and fourth ones is all about them trying to build a society in this world and the sort of the outside, you know, forces that are stopping them from being able to try to recreate the world, but in different settings. But like the last setting that they've done with The Walking Dead at Alexandria, they've been there for like three or four seasons now. So they've built this place up. They've given you these characters. They've given you a status quo, and they branch stories off of that status quo. The problem I really have with Fear of the Walking Dead is that it never gives anything that time. That there's even the first season, which is actually just like six or seven episodes long, it's like split in half with two different settings. There's the beginning of the fall of civilization, and then there's we're stuck in this neighborhood that's just been fenced off and is being, you know, occupied by the military, which I think is a cool setting. The idea of, well, what do we do with those? Because countless places in the original Walking Dead show where they go to some place to find supplies and they see all the tents and tanks and stuff set up, but it's all long abandoned and there's zombies there. It's like this is one of those places before it fell apart. I think you could do, you know, the same thing, the tension with the military. What are we doing? Are they just going to kill us and disappear? And they abandon these ideas sometimes after two or three episodes. Like the big one at starting of season two was we're going to be on a boat that one of the characters is a rich guy who has this like $7 million yacht, you know, with all the Star Trek looking navigation equipment. And it's like practically apartment building that's going around on the high seas. It's really beautiful.
Which does make for an interesting idea for a zombie story, right? Because you can get away from them.
Yeah,
you can actually get away from them.
You're on the high seas, but now you're trying
to... You don't have to worry about your helicopter fuel in that respect, right?
Yeah, that you I guess there is boat fuel that you have to
sails.
Get. Sails. Yeah, sails.
Yeah.
But you have to get around. You have to occasionally touch down on land to get food and supplies.
Right.
That you have to deal with, you know, pirates or people that are going to come and try to rob you. That you're surrounded on all sides by water and sense that you're kind of trapped in this big empty ocean that's not so empty. Because, you know, zombies floating around.
Right.
And that's such a great idea. And it's also so completely different from the original Walking Dead, which, of course, is sort of set in the area between kind of like Georgia and D.C. And is kind of a much more standard zombie apocalypse type show. where this one is like, oh, wow. And then plus them going south on the boat. So suddenly they're not in the United States anymore, and they're in Mexico, and everyone speaks Spanish. So there's a language barrier, and there's also a cultural barrier, and also seeing places that aren't random American city, you know, being overrun by zombies. And it's like, oh, wow, we're doing something new. Then they just abandoned the boat after like six episodes. And I'm like, holy shit, that was a really cool set and a really cool idea. Now they're like, okay, well, we're going to set up in this luxury hotel, and we're going to be there with the wait staff and the people that were at like their parents' anniversary. And they're like, okay, now we're together. We're going to barricade this. We're building a society. Oh, they get exiled from that after like four episodes. And I'm like, well,
set piece of the week sort of thing.
Yeah, like we just went through the whole lengthy process of cleaning out the hotel and building, you know, character relationships between all these people. But fuck it.
It occurs to me that that what you said at the beginning is that Fear the Walking Dead took what was an opposite tack from what The Walking Dead did. Because Fear the Walking Dead, you wanted to see it at the beginning before society had actually fallen. But the problem is you can't stay there, right?
No.
And then very soon you're going to be basically right where The Walking Dead is, in that same spot. So in any case, you can start off with that idea, but you're going to end up basically doing the same stuff that, you know, that the original show does.
How do you build that separate identity? What is the zombie version of Deep Space Nine?
Yeah.
Where it's not, I mean, Deep Space Nine did something pretty radical.
Right.
That I don't think any Star Trek show has tried to do since. There's still a lot of Star Trek shows are still using the original series model of we're on a ship, we're exploring, we're doing Star Trek-y missions.
Yeah,
we're going
adventure of the week.
We encounter and interact with civilization, and then we're gone. And we're on to the next thing. That Picard has a speech about this, and he leaves them in a place where these people have something to think about now. And either that or Kirk has destroyed yet another civilization that's being run by an evil computer.
Yes, of course.
And now they have to rebuild from scratch. But then Kirk gets in the ship, and then the last shot is the Enterprise flying away.
Yep.
And Deep Space Nine goes, well, what if they can't leave? What if people are constantly coming to them? What if there are people not in Starfleet that didn't sign on for the Prime Directive or the sort of Starfleet ethos? And what if they were sort of hanging around? So it creates a completely different tone. They're not always going to new places. They're having to deal with diversity that's always there. Having to try to, you know, coexist with different societies, Quark and Odo and Kira and all these characters who are not Starfleet characters. But they're part of sort of the ecosystem of the space station. And Walking Dead needs something of that, something that kind of breaks the formula, but also does things that make you look at the formula in a completely different way.
Yeah, I suppose what we were, our impetus for having this discussion was sort of about this. Now it'll be a growing trend of taking a very successful formula, be it a movie or TV show, more so now television shows, and the idea of spinoffs. And of course, we're like recording this a couple weeks after HBO has announced, I think they're going to have no less than 5 spinoffs to Game of Thrones that will either run concurrently or after the whole series, the original series, actually ends. And I think, I don't know if they're, I really, it's funny because of all the hot takes on the internet, I don't think I read anyone who's like, oh yeah, I'm totally game for this, 100% game. I think that sounds like a little much.
It does.
You know what? It sounds like I'm not going to watch all 6 of those.
How about you announce one spinoff?
Right.
One spinoff, and to see if there's anyone to bite for assuming that everyone is going to be on board with 12 things. It's kind of like the same thing that every one of these post-Marvel cinematic universe type shared universe attempts have done, whether it's DC or the Dark Universe.
Oh my God, don't get me started about the complete inanity of Universal having, I guess, the only set of properties of IP that they have not yet been able to farm, which is their monster movies.
Their monster movies. And it's also their second attempt because the first time, actually, same with DC. The DC, I think, was originally supposed to build it off of Green Lantern.
Oh, yeah, that didn't go well.
That did not go well. So they started again with Man of Steel. And I think with Universal, it was going to be Dracula Untold. I don't know if I, Frankenstein, had anything to do with it. But sort of the, it's like this idea of...
Poor Aaron Eckhart. He's such a great actor. I don't know how he got fucking shackled to that atrocity.
There's a lot of those where it's like not a superhero movie, but it's marketed and filmed like a superhero movie where the monster jumps from the roof and falls in a 3-point stance. And he's just like, you know, it begins.
I mean, is this kind of the world that Blade wrought right?
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, for better or for worse, if Blade hadn't have happened, you wouldn't have had this kind of, like, I'm a monster-killing monster.
Yeah, but also just the vibe of these movies, that just feel like Gods of Egypt or that King Arthur movie.
Oh, Lord.
Like, the King Arthur movie, does that not feel like a superhero movie just with, it's
and of
course, daddy's fairy tale.
Yes. And, of course, that was something that, I don't remember which studio did it. They had five other King Arthur movies hanging on this.
The hubris. That's what I'm talking about. It's one thing to make a thing and see, hey, let's see if this goes. And if it works out, we have an idea to do more. But it's not, it's like a treatment. It's like, I've got a 20-page document that says this is where we could go from here if this turns out to strike gold. But instead, they immediately greenlit like 20 movies and say, it doesn't matter. We don't know if people like Man of Steel or The Mummy yet. We're going to tell you that we've got a map for like up until like 2025 of all these movies that we're going to do coalescing in this big event. And you're like, I don't know if I've bought in yet.
We've financially engineered $2.5 billion to make sure that we are going to make these movies.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's. But then you have the same problem that you have with DC. It was like, what if you're already making sequels when the first one comes out? And people don't like that first movie.
Right. You got to course correct mid-production.
Mid-production, not even mid-writing. It's not. And that's the thing that was kind of great about sequels and stuff in the old days, as I shake my cane at you and tell you.
In my day, sequels were different.
Yeah, well, I think they were a bit more cautious in the sense of, with Lord of the Rings, it makes sense because it's one big story to film all at once.
Right.
But with a lot of things, how do you know that if people want this thing? So you're already Man of Steel comes out and you're already mid-production on Suicide Squad and Batman v Superman. And people hate the tone that you've doubled down on and probably already spent millions of dollars on. That you've already gotten people, there's no reason to do anything other than have a contract to keep a director and a star on hold.
Sure.
In case. And then maybe go through, but you've already written it and you're making it. And now people hate that tone. Now you have to rewrite, refilm, and reproduce. Talk about making a Frankenstein monster of a movie that may not fit together because the initial tone and there are scenes that don't work because there's a context missing because everything builds into something like, and you eventually have a movie where the scenes that are released, like with Rogue One, aren't actually in that teaser trailer that you put out.
Right. Oh, yes. Of course.
So it's a completely different movie.
And the idea that Suicide Squad was radically changed after the response from the first trailer. Like, they decided, oh, my God, people like this trailer. Let's recut the movie with the company that made the trailer. It says to me that there's an insecurity about the idea that especially if it's like, oh, this has got to be a $1 billion-plus sort of international movie, there's such an insecurity about a singular director, a writer, there's such an insecurity about letting it just sort of be its own thing, letting it go from start to finish with the normal sort of give and take of that collaborative works actually have, such that now, up until the moment that they got to print out that file, the last week that they got to do it before the London premiere or whatever, it's all in flux.
Yeah.
It's there, you know. I think digital technology allows for that to happen, so in some ways that's good. It also seems like it's also terrible because now meddling can happen at more points of the process than it did before.
And when the movie costs like $150 to $250 million, and that's the other thing too. It's not just the production itself, but it's also the promotion.
Yeah.
It costs so much money, so you're going to get way more meddling because there's so much money on the table at risk that you're like, oh God, no, people hate this other movie we just put out, but we're already filmed about 45% of this other one. What are we going to do? Oh shit, what else is popular? Now you're making artistic decisions out of a panic.
Mm-hmm.
So Suicide Squad, what else is popular? Guardians of the Galaxy, we got to get some pop songs in here. And oh shit, what else? Let's make it more like Deadpool. And the difference with, say, Deadpool was that was a movie that the suits didn't want to have made.
Of course.
Now, I don't think Deadpool is the best, greatest movie in the world, but it's a movie that has a very specific point of view. It has a vision and has a tone that is so consistent. And it was a tone that the studio didn't want, that the money people didn't want, that it was all Ryan Reynolds, the director and the writer, who were all like, no, this shit is fucking funny and we like it and it's fun. And them saying, you know, using every last favor they have to get this thing made in a very specific way with a very consistent vision.
Right.
And it ended up being their biggest movie that they've ever put out in the X-Men franchise.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, see, that in and of itself should make them stand up and take notice. But I mean, it doesn't matter how subjectively terrible of a filmed piece of entertainment something like Batman versus Superman is, it still just brings people out in droves and sells well internationally. So unfortunately, that market thing that's supposed to whip it into shape, for some of these things, they just keep going. They just keep going and keep going and keep going. And I'll say that to DC's credit, if you're looking at Wonder Woman as a movie, which I think we will talk about in another separate space, I think we're going to talk about Wonder Woman then here. You can say that DC at least has been getting incrementally better.
I think Wonder Woman is the first movie that was made after all of that stuff settled.
Yeah.
So it gets to be a different animal from the beginning, where it wasn't already made. And also it has a different creative vision for it. That
yes,
Patty
an
Jenkins,
outsider. And basically an outsider to the Zack Snyder,
that she wasn't,
David Goyer cabal.
She wasn't making the third movie in a Zack Snyder series.
No.
And also she was like, wow, I don't like that. I like this instead. Yeah. And you got a different animal rather than an animal that started one thing and then you just like taped wings and a unicorn horn on and tried to pretend that it's always been a unicorn.
Have you? No, I think that we're circling this point here, but I think I'm aligning with what I've heard you say twice now, not on the podcast, either the podcast, which is I now basically have no expectations of big universe things anymore. I don't like even like my darling of something like Blade Runner, the new Blade Runner movie or whatever. Like
you mean Gray T-shirt the movie?
Yes. There's maybe this is just cynicism, but I don't. I don't get onto the hype anymore for any of this stuff. There's no reason to.
Well, we live in a very different world than when we were teenagers. If you liked nerdy shit in the 90s, you didn't get that much stuff.
No.
And you kind of learned to... You have a lot... I mean, both of us. Look at the level of affection there is for the movie Space Jam, which is as cynical a movie as can possibly exist. It's a feature-length Nike commercial.
I've never seen Space Jam, but continue.
It's got Bill Murray in it. Yeah. But it's a Bugs Bunny, Michael Jordan flick, where they're fighting animated space monsters who've stolen the basketball skills of all of these big players and have challenged the Looney Tunes to a basketball game. And
that's it.
It's expanded from a commercial. But there's a lot. Same thing with like the love of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and a lot of other things that people who love them objectively know they're not good.
Yeah.
But
Saved by the Bell, I think, would be
another. Oh, Saved by the Bell is full of that.
It's terrible.
It's terrible. It is a terrible show. But I think that, you know, we had that sort of thing where right now, if you like superhero movies, you're not getting one every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
You're getting them like 4 or 5 a year. And you can take your pick now. That same thing, there is all the DC Warner Brothers TV shows. And I was going to say WB, but it's CW now.
It's not WB. The WB. I didn't even factor that in when I was thinking about this. Yes, both DC and Marvel have like a bunch of shows running concurrently.
There's TV.
A shit ton of them.
There's movies. We're flooded with stuff.
Yeah.
And it's both a good and a bad thing. It's a bad thing that it just gets tiring, and I think it sucks a lot of oxygen out of the room for other things that are different and aren't attached to previously created characters and franchises that have a built-in fan base. Mm-hmm. But I think the other problem, the good part of it, I think, is that we have the freedom to be so picky as nerds now.
Yeah.
And I mean, even if I wanted to watch all of these shows, I do not have enough hours in my life to watch all of them.
I mean, the long tail is extraordinarily long now, and the choice fatigue is like it's a real struggle to be able to find what entertainment I actually want to watch, you know. So the, this is also something that becomes, because of the long tail being so long, this is also something that I think is a time bomb waiting to explode underneath DC or underneath Marvel, which is they could easily be unseated now. It's so much easier to launch something on Netflix or with like small studios like A24 who are releasing amazing stuff. It is so much easier to light a fire under and make something that's huge and carry a thing or a set of things, of properties forward to unseat and undermine them. It really is. There will always be affection for Superman and Batman, for sure. There always will be. But they're more vulnerable than they ever have been, especially because there's their commitment to making these huge expanded universe, shared universe franchise things basically puts their eggs in fewer baskets.
Yeah, there's so much money going into this. I think, one, it makes worse movies because of the meddling, because of studio heads. But I think also the fact that I'm much less aware of mid to low budget action, sci-fi, horror, drama, comedy films than I ever have been. Because almost all of the pop culture awareness is getting sucked up by the really big $100 million things.
Yeah, no doubt.
There's all these great, like, there's a trailer that I've seen over the past, half a year. And it's a movie I desperately want to see, but I don't hear anyone talking about it, which is Baby Driver, the Edgar Wright movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I remember that there was you can just look at the trailers and ads that they're putting out for it to say, this is an adaptation based on the world that we are in, where movies have to hit their high ratings all over their ads. Like, you know, they're just, the Baby Driver ads are full of the 5-star reviews,
right.
100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I mean, not only that, trailers now, I'm sure you've noticed the creeping trend of a trailer before a trailer.
Yeah.
You know, where you see like a 5-second smash of a bunch of images and then the trailer ends up starting. Trailers have to trailer themselves to keep your attention now.
Yeah, it's weird. So Baby Driver looks amazing.
Yeah, it does.
And it's pushing itself so hard. But the thing that makes me sad is I know it's not going to be the hit that it would have been had it come out 10 years ago.
Oh, sure.
Because there are so many blockbusters that are out there. And I love blockbusters. I'm somebody who, I do like superheroes a lot. I love superheroes more than most people. I don't have the same superhero fatigue that a lot of my friends do. But even I have my fucking limits. Where we've hit the point now where we're so inundated with certain things that I need them to change and be unique. They need to hit their Deep Space Nine moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you have something like Logan, you're like, wow, this is something that is trying something different. Even though it has a big budget, it feels small. It feels personal.
Yeah.
And we've waxed Logan's car for quite a bit, but
we've polished that knob.
Oh my
for
God.
Sure.
It is sparkling.
See the last time Joe Preddy was on the show.
It was trying something. And I love Marvel as much as anybody, but with very few exceptions, there is a Marvel formula.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves kind of having a weak villain, focusing on the hero. There's a tone that sometimes verges on flip it to the point that you don't really feel stakes in the movie. You never really feel like your heroes are really in that much danger.
Oh, I can see that.
It's fun, yeah. And I love it, but when you get a bunch of those in a row and then, say, I go back and watch the original Terminator, suddenly that's terrifying. Or the original Mad Max, it's terrifying. Not a lot of movies are willing to make me sad. Because they have to play everywhere. Because to make back $200 million, you have to make everybody happy. And like one of the things I just saw recently was It Comes at Night, which is a fairly low budget A24 horror movie, and it was great. And it was a movie for the first time I've actually seen somebody get up and walk out of the movie.
Oh wow. Not because were they offended by the gore or what? Was it just too intense?
Well, it was intense. Oh. The thing with this movie is it's not a crowd pleaser.
Oh, good. Good.
It comes at night. I mean, it's nice that something just doesn't have to make you happy all the time. And I don't mean just like, you know, Batman v Superman is depressing. But I don't want a depressing Superman movie. But a movie that with It Comes at Night is, it's intense. It's about it's not a monster slasher. It's about paranoia. It's about fear. Hmm. It's about suspicion. Hmm. It's about growing tension. And then the finale, the climax of this movie, can be really hard to watch. But it's a thing that you're watching that feels like it's become increasingly inevitable over the course of the movie. That you're not shocked that it's happening. You don't want it to happen. But it's going to happen, and it hurts to watch it. It really hurts to watch it. And it's like watching these people just suffer in this moment. And it isn't visceral. I get no sense of satisfaction from it. You're just like, you feel like you've been in a car accident. And the weird thing is, the point at which that the people walked out was 5 minutes before it ended.
Oh, whoa. Wow.
It was the climax. It was that point where they're like, oh, shit.
They blew their wads and they had to go home.
They just they thought that it was going to pull out of this nosedive.
They were edging and it didn't happen.
Yes. this was the point where it was like, nope, this isn't another movie.
I see.
This isn't going to have that last minute Deus Ex Machina.
Right.
Everything's not going to be a fan. It's one of the reasons that I really love The Mist.
Yeah.
The Mist doubles down on that.
Yes. Since we've talked about it on the show, I've actually watched The Mist.
You have?
Which I love it. I loved it a lot. I think the more I see Thomas Jane and stuff, the more I'm like, this guy needs to get more work.
He's
sure.
Great. I love Tom Jane. He just wants to get his kids back.
Yeah. And everything. In The Mist, it's the same thing, too, where it, like, horror movies often have this thing where that... And I'm no big fan of the horror genre. I just seem to be watching a lot more of them now, which says, I think, a lot about the elasticity, the plasticity of the genre and the ability to do unique shit, singular, unique shit. Mist is uncomfortable in the way that other horror movies are, which is that you're watching people make mistakes and you know they're going to be punished for it. And some of the characters are smarter than the rest of them. And those are the ones you glom onto, right? You glom onto the smart ones because you want them to survive.
And what's great about the ending of that movie, without spoiling it, is that you followed them and said, oh, these people make good decisions. These are the people that I want to identify with. And they make a decision that is the wrong one.
Yeah.
And the ending of that movie is the horrible cost of that decision.
Yeah, it's a real gut punch of an ending. And you've got to love how daring, I guess it's Frank Darabont, so the guy who did Shawshank Redemption and Green Mile, so he can do anything he wants to at that point, right? Another $150 million movie, this would not be able to happen.
No, they would never. The money, they would never say, there'd be all these people that would be upset at this dark ending. And I think people don't want to go into a movie and be uncomfortable.
Right.
They want it to be kind of like a roller coaster where there's ups, there's downs. The downs don't go really down that far, and it doesn't feel like anything is going to fly off the handle. That you're never going to have a truly dark Night of the Living Dead type ending where the main character gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
Also, movies that make you not jump scares, but movies that have a sense of pervasive dread. People just aren't comfortable with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, great example, Get Out was one of the best movies of this last year.
Yeah, I agree too. It's that, and I think we might have just got the thing that cut across our entire discussion, which is it's not bankable to have these movies that or these TV shows that people walk into and they end up being in a different place than they actually wanted. It's only bankable to have this completely trod over very sort of vanilla, milquetoast, repeatable formula, and to stretch that out until you can't do it anymore, until, you know, the Police Academy thing where the amount that you spend to make the movie and the amount that it makes back eventually degrades to the point where it's not profitable and then you cut them off. It's the movies that you can walk into a movie theater and then you leave and you're just like, oh, I didn't know I could feel that way. Swiss Army Man was one of those ones for me, which is you thought it was going to be a stupid comedy about a farting corpse, and it ends up being kind of this weird bromance fantasy love story about
insecurity.
Yeah, about insecurity, about learning how to be yourself in the world, and about insecurity and about finding a friend, like,
and shame.
Yes, it's definitely just, about, like, I felt like just rapturous joy at parts of that movie, and you wouldn't have expected it watching the trailer.
But yeah, and it's an ending too that is willing to make you uncomfortable.
Right, right.
And it was one that I loved because
my wife hated that ending. She was like, "But was it real? Was it not real?
It made,
you go into a movie, it's fine. It's just not
real. It made the movie for me.
Yeah,
the ending. It really made it where I'm like, oh shit, right? It puts everything in context, and I really dug it.
So yeah, movies that make you feel something you did not expect to feel.
That's great. I want to go in and have an experience that isn't just, wow, that was fun. I mean, I loved watching a lot of movies. I mean, I really liked seeing Ant-Man. It was great. It had the same thing a lot of Marvel movies have, which is a compelling, charming performance from a lead, fun characters, fun dialogue, a neat, clever action scene. But I haven't watched that once since it came out in theaters. And no. I don't really see myself doing it. And again, I've said this before, probably at least 12 times about Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange is a fun movie, again, with a charming, compelling lead and fun side characters, a couple clever things. But aside from the last scene of Dormammu, I Come to Bargain, which I could happily watch that on YouTube a bunch of times. Yeah. I'm not going to watch the whole movie, though.
Yeah.
That sometimes I just want to see a scene, and that's all that movie really is to me from that point on. But it's like what we've said about a bunch of movies. It's like there are movies that you could watch from start to finish a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Back to the Future, Terminator 2.
I just watched Spirited Away today. That was one of those.
Yeah.
Absolutely shockingly rewatchable. Yeah, and I had that same thought too. What was I was thinking about? I can't remember what movie I was thinking about, where there are some movies that are so forgettable, but they exist by virtue, they persist by virtue of the fact that they have one scene in them that some of the flavor that's unique enough that you could actually remember it. And then there are those amazing movies for which they have a dozen of those.
Yeah.
And that's really the ultimate test of the longevity of something, is how much of it you actually keeps rolling back around in your brain, for sure.
Yeah, the stuff that I've
certainly
watched.
Certainly most of Doctor Strange is not that.
No, I enjoyed it, but yeah. You know, I'm probably not going to revisit it. I was thinking about this because I know I announced this earlier in the year, but I still am doing the 365 movie challenge. I'm up to 158 I've seen so far. And the movies that have really stood out to me this year, the ones that have really jumped out and I find myself thinking about it, is stuff like The Nice Guys, which I really loved. I really love Drive.
Oh, yeah.
The Nicholas Winding Refn one.
Yeah.
I love Drive. My brain, again, Swiss Army Man that you mentioned before, Get Out. None of these are $200 million movies.
Nope.
But they have this very specific individual tone and feel, and something that I find myself revisiting in my brain after I've seen it.
I feel like if I'm to sort of place myself in devil's advocate instead of just sort of like buck-toothed, pimple-faced, simpleton moviegoer advocate. I don't know how best to completely straw man this. But if I were to make it, you know, you like movies that aren't fun to watch.
Oh yeah,
right. And I think that's where I completely hit a brick wall with the other, you know, with the way the other half lives. Where I'm just like, no. If I'm bored in a fucking movie because I'm three steps ahead of the movie, it's not worth my time. Yeah. It really isn't.
I don't mind a slow burn movie. I don't know if there's been a change in our cultural tastes, you know, that we don't like a movie that takes its time. Like Drive is one that I think probably suffered from the trailers misrepresenting it.
Well, it's not just when a movie is deliberate and it rewards an audience for being patient. Nice Guys is not a slow burn movie, but it's a really fucking good movie.
Yeah.
And because the movie is ahead of you, you are not ahead of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the only one that I think was a truly great movie that fits into the sort of massive franchise, but it's an outlier of that franchise, is again Logan, that I saw this year.
Yeah.
Again, what's wax that car, just beat the drum for Logan. But again,
really, we're just getting a cut from Fox. You know, every single time we mention it, we're getting a percentage.
Yeah, but it's a sense of
hello, studio, send that check to me.
It doesn't care about the continuity. It's not desperately doing Easter eggs or being cute.
Right.
And that was the thing, is it was a singular experience. And a lot of superhero movies have sort of fallen into, this is a formula that works, so let's just keep doing it, and just swapping out sort of the genre nouns and the lead character who has different kind of powers, a different compelling lead, and just kind of coasting on that. And I think Logan did something that, again, it was willing to make you sad. And a lot of movies aren't willing to make you sad anymore. Yeah. But yeah, I think at some point we should probably do a Black Ops episode that's just about my list. We can go through that.
That would be good, actually. That would be good. That would to pick out some highlights of the list. You certainly have seen, with the exception of some of the your sort of Rockford File TV movies, which I probably will never go back and see, you've now seen, there are some of them I'm just like, fuck, Mike saw that one? Now I got to see it. Now I got to jump on that.
There's some great stuff that I've seen so far. Yeah. I saw a Korean spaghetti western.
Yes, this is definitely the one that I want to see, too.
Oh, God. The Good, the Bad, the Weird is on Netflix. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a Korean take on an Italian take on an American genre. So it's a sort of fits the same kind of the inspiration, like Sam Peckinpah, Sergio Leone movies. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly is the obvious inspiration.
Sure.
Where it takes place in 1935 Manchuria.
Oh, wow.
And
That's great.
The lead characters, the good, the bad, and the weird, you know, the same kind of formula as the Eastwood, as there's a badass bounty hunter guy who is hunting down the bad, and the bad is, the good is the bounty hunter. He's he's like a total badass with his lever-action rifle and his trench coat. And the bad is this assassin with a gang of assassins who has been hired by a crime boss to steal back a treasure map that the crime boss just sold to another bad guy. So I got the money and I'm going to get the map back.
Right.
So he's going to send him on a train robbery. But the train is already robbed beforehand by a petty thief who is the weird.
That's awesome.
So the petty thief has a treasure map. They don't actually know what's the treasure is, just that it's a location and everyone, including there's like a city of thieves. There is like these crazy, wonderful action sequences that are kind of like a mix of Peckinpah style westerns, John Woo style like gung fu movies from Hong Kong, and there's some martial arts influence. There's a real love of all these different genres getting kind of thrown together in a pot and stirred. So it's just a great movie.
That's great.
Yeah, The Train to Busan. I don't know.
Yeah, also on the list.
A Korean zombie movie on a train.
Yeah. It's about a lot of these inventive Korean movies are about being on a train, like Snowpiercer.
Oh, yeah, just and like stuff that I hadn't seen before. I just hadn't got around. Like, I saw Casablanca for the first time.
Well,
I loved it. It was great.
Propaganda, that movie.
Yeah.
Straight propaganda.
Oh, I love it. I love the police character in that movie.
Yes.
I love a character that's that kind of, you know, openly corrupt, but kind of genial.
Well, I can't compete with any of those, but I did see Sam Peckinpah's 1978 classic Convoy, starring Kris Kristofferson.
Oh, the trucker movie.
Yes. It was a movie based on the song.
The novelty song?
Yeah, so you don't think it's like, oh, they made a, you know, there was a movie, and then, of course, they had a hit song that they, the studio and the record label. No. The song came out first, and then they made a movie, and it's essentially like, it is a vigilante movie, but instead of the vigilante being, you know, this weathered guy who's had enough with the crime in his city, and he takes a gun and kills people. He is a trucker. Is Kris Kristofferson is this super hot, attractive trucker who keeps getting shaken down by Dirty Earl. I think it's Arizona. Dirty Earl is a sheriff in a small county who shakes down the truckers. He basically stops them, extracts money from them, and that's how he makes his living. Kris Kristofferson basically leads him on a multi-state chase, and in doing so becomes like, not unlike Charles Bronson's
Richard
character.
Branson.
Not Richard Branson at all. Charles Bronson's character in the Death Wish series, he becomes an inspiration, and this convoy expands to people that are just like trucks and people that are following him to follow his
jogging.
Yeah, exactly right. And then of course at the end he has to basically face down like the National Guard on a bridge, and his
truck, he got five stars.
Yes, he did get five stars. But he, unlike a vigilante movie, he actually never uses a gun, which is interesting. Anyways, Sam Peckinpah, there's not enough like pink blood, not enough Klingon blood for a Sam Peckinpah movie. Have you ever seen him? He usually has Klingon blood.
Oh God, I The Wild Bunch is honestly one of my favorite movies. It's definitely top 50.
Oh my God, yes.
Oh, it's great. It's wonderful, and I see that the influence of that on something like Red Dead Redemption is really clear.
Oh, of course.
But yeah, I think that's kind of what I want. I want more stuff that is original and surprising. I want to go to a movie and be surprised. Like John Wick was one of the most wonderful surprises, and that's a movie that we're constantly just, we won't shut up about John Wick.
No.
And for good reason, is I want that experience. I want to go to a movie theater and come out not knowing that I was going to feel a certain way.
You know what? You when we were talking about this before, you said, do you think a movie like The Matrix is possible? Was like, do you think the movie like The Matrix is possible? I think John Wick trilogy is like that.
Yeah, but John Wick is probably not as big as The Matrix.
No, I mean, it was not as big as The Matrix. It didn't have the sort of thing where it not only became sort of a very popular movie, but also a very well-crafted deconstruction of the genres it was trying to, as long as it was basically trying to tread on. For John Wick, it was a sleeper hit and a smaller production that had modest success at the box office, but was also a fantastic deconstruction of its genres that ended up surprising people and bringing a lot of people through word of mouth. And wait, they both have Keanu in them?
They do. Yeah. But yeah, I think
motherfucker can pick his roles. He can. He really can.
He's good. He commits to something in a way that I don't think a lot of people do. But I think The Matrix was this massive thing in the late 90s where it took over pop culture for a while. The bullet time thing was in every video game.
Yeah.
Every other movie was doing the slow motion dodge thing.
Yeah. Boy, that got tired really quickly seeing that shit.
It was just everywhere. And every one of those bad parody movies would do that shit over. I think there's one where a cow does it. Or somebody's fighting a cow and doing the slow motion dodge. There's some really awful shit. But that's an indication of how deeply entrenched into pop culture it was. That it was fucking everywhere. And nowadays, is it even possible for a movie that isn't based on a pre-existing franchise or character or book or something that has a built-in fan base to get that big? Can you even find any oxygen to breathe in a world where there are other movies? Like the King Arthur movie.
Yeah.
If it came out in the late 90s, maybe it would be bigger than it is. But it probably would never be a hit. But I think that nowadays you're competing with all of these superhero movies. All of these blockbusters.
And we may not be able to answer that question just because of what you said. Maybe there can't be that kind of without a pre-existing franchise that becomes this sort of sleeper hit because the market is so saturated.
In the late
90s, the market was not saturated. In the 90s was sort of exemplified by mostly middle-range budget movies.
Yeah.
Like $20 to $40 million movies.
I see no reason why we can't do that again. But again, I think things can happen. I want to find a counterexample to my own argument. Stranger Things is probably the only example of something that I think got that big.
That came up in my head before, but yeah, I agree.
It's something that has the advantage of being on Netflix, that people are already paying for it and didn't know, and they might as well watch it. I think Netflix is one of the few places where you can do something weird and become a hit. And you can gather by word of mouth because it's there. You don't have to catch it before it leaves theaters.
And there's not that sense of there's not the artificial scarcity of it runs only for only a limited time in theaters, and there's so many seats or screens in a theater at once. You know, there's that ceiling doesn't exist now.
Yeah, and I can also watch it at 3 a.m. if I want to.
Yeah.
There's never a point where I have to make time for this, that a movie theater is only going to be open, the last showing is at 11.
Right.
And, you know, you could work any schedule and find time for Stranger Things.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's kind of what it is I want that to come back. I want something that feels like I didn't have it before. And again, horror movies are doing it.
That is so fucking crazy. You can have it. I thought this was this thing in the 90s, and sci-fi was the place of oh my God, there are these crazy sci-fi movies that no one expected, like Fifth Element, that came out, and you're like, oh, these are amazing. Horror seems to be the genre that's doing it now.
Yeah.
That's that little place where the seed can grow, can break through the soil.
Because it has a tiny buy-in for the studios, it can take more risks. It can have a specific audience. That guy who walked out of It Comes at Night was not the person that movie was for.
Right.
And that movie is going to be for somebody else who was just like me, we're just going, holy shit, I feel kind of terrible and I need a chaser movie. the anecdote I just tell over and over again this year is that the day that I watched Old Boy, I also watched Zootopia right after. Just to get myself out of that feeling.
Yeah. That's a mind fuck of a movie.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It's movies that are willing to do that. And I think fewer and fewer of them are when you go to the big budget thing. So I find actually that's the best thing that's come out of doing this this challenge, this New Year's resolution, is that I have no reason to not see something. And I find myself specifically seeking out movies like that.
Yeah.
Because the me of like 3 years ago, I would probably see 5-6 movies a year, and they would almost all be blockbusters. Mm-hmm. They would almost all be like a superhero movie. Oh, okay, well, I saw, like, I did see Alien Covenant when it came out.
Oh, Lord.
But we can talk about that.
I was going to say, we'll have more to, I think we'll have more to talk about that later.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm also seeing a lot of other things. Like, I saw Get Out in theaters. I saw Colossal, which was great.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Amazing movie.
There's some great stuff. Yeah. And those, you know, Colossal should be more colossal than it was.
Yep.
It's a great movie that doesn't get enough attention. But again, if you expect it just to be an Anne Hathaway kaiju movie with monsters fighting, that's not what it is.
Right.
It's just a metaphor. It's the excuse to have very human drama play out.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that was, it was one of the best movies I've seen. I think it would probably make my top 25 at least of the year.
It's great. It's good. Watch it. Basically, what we're saying is just don't fucking watch blockbuster movies, right? Is that the?
Well, I wouldn't say don't, but
don't do it. Put down the wallet.
Be pickier with your time.
Yeah,
that there's some really good stuff out there, and you know, I'd much rather watch another version of John Wick 2 or Logan or The Good, the Bad, the Weird or Train to Busan or those movies I enjoy a lot more. Like I just watched a documentary called Chuck Norris versus Communism about people who in Romania in like 1985 were smuggling VHS tapes of Western movies in and how it was just quietly changing the culture. To a place that was incredibly repressed and they didn't have freedom of speech, and watching something like Dirty Dancing or Back to the Future was illegal.
That's crazy.
And how seeing something like, you know, First Blood Part 2 made them go, you know, fuck it. I can say no to a guy with a gun. And it gets some credit for the slow change of the culture and being able to see what the world is like outside of this insulated, oppressive regime that you're under and going, yeah, fuck this. You know, I want to be a hero like I saw in that movie. I want to stick up to some. It's like bad guys that look a lot like that guy who's come in to check to see if I'm doing anything bad.
Are you trying to make the claim that Canon Films was responsible for the fall of the Iron Curtain?
I won't say that they were, but I'm saying that they probably helped loosen the jar.
Radio vs. the Martians is produced by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. Our editor was Mike Gillis. Our theme music was written and performed by Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Find us online at radioversusthemartians.com and send us your feedback at info@radioversusthemartians.com.
At 0800 hours, station time. The Romulan Empire formally declared war against the Dominion. They have already struck 15 bases along the Cardassian border. So, this is a huge victory for the good guys. This may even be the turning point of the entire war. There is even a welcome to the fight party tonight in the ward room. So, I lied. I cheated. I bribed men to cover the crimes of other men. I am an accessory to murder. But the most damning thing of all, I think I can live with it. And if I had to do it all over again, I would. Garrick was right about one thing. A guilty conscience is a small price to pay for the safety of the Alpha Quadrant. So I will learn to live with it.
because I can live with it. I can live with it. Computer, erase that entire personal log.